Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
We've all heard stories about how easy it is for people with bad intent to buy guns, but the traffic in stolen firearms may be a bigger problem than anyone imagined.
So what you have is this dynamic where you have gun dealers who are operating for years, sometimes as many as 5-7 years, without ever getting a visit from ATF to make sure that they are operating their business appropriately.
Also this week, a cost of living adjustment for public schools is raising the ire of Florida's county school boards.
Just give us our dollar back. That's what I'm asking for. We send a dollar, let's have our dollar back.
We'll also learn how some websites openly promote sex trafficking. We'll get a Zika virus update and dive into the angry controversy over chubby shorts. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. More than 80,000 guns were stolen in Florida between 2012 and 2013, according to a new report by the left-leaning Center for American Progress. Advocates blame weak laws and lax oversight. But as Jim Ash reports, a lead federal law enforcement agent is vowing to turn the trend around.
According to the Center for American Progress, thieves are stealing an average of 55 guns a day in Florida. Researchers base their estimate on FBI reports of the total value of all guns stolen in the U.S. But much more is at stake than dollars and cents, says Patty Brigham, co-chair of the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence.
Human lives are at stake, and oftentimes when guns are stolen, they fall into criminal hands. So people that are stealing these weapons are usually up to no good.
The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says thefts from federally licensed gun dealers spiked nearly 60% nationwide last year. Florida, Georgia, and Texas had the most thefts, according to the reports. Law enforcement agents take gun theft very seriously because they have a lot to lose, says Daryl McCrary, special agent in charge of the ATF's Tampa field office.
In Florida, there have been instances where these firearms have been stolen and then used in violent crimes. So it's definitely of concern to us here at ATF, and I'm sure it's of concern to other state and local federal law enforcement agencies that may have to come in contact with these individuals that have these stolen firearms.
McCrary's office oversees all but 10 southeastern counties in Florida. McCrary says his agents are conducting seminars, meeting with store owners, and speaking out to local media to combat the thefts. The solution, McCrary says, is to make the guns less accessible because thieves are looking for a quick getaway. Chelsea Parsons, lead author of the Center for American Progress report, says ATF could be even more effective if conservative Republicans hadn't attached about a dozen restrictive riders to the agency's annual budget.
And one of those riders prohibits ATF from requiring licensed gun dealers to do an annual check of their inventory to make sure that they're not missing any guns.
Congress also limits ATF's effectiveness through lean budgets, Parsons says. The result, she says, is fewer and fewer agents policing more and more licensed gun dealers.
So what you have is this dynamic where you have gun dealers who are operating for years, sometimes as many as 5-7 years, without ever getting a visit from ATF to make sure that they are operating their business appropriately.
McCrary says his field office is responsible for monitoring some 3,000 federally licensed gun dealers. He insists he has the resources he needs.
You know, we really don't get into the number of agents we have, but I have at my disposal at any given time, what I need to get my jobs done, to get, you know, what we have to cover done here in Florida, and I have access to other personnel as needed as well.
McCrary says he would always welcome more agents. But to him, it's a matter of working smarter, not harder. McCrary says it's not up to him to tell Congress to require store owners to use tighter inventory controls. But he says many in Florida already do.
Certainly, we know that some FFLs do do these voluntarily. We certainly appreciate that. We think it's a good business practice. But again, you know, a lot of this is working smarter, not harder.
Parsons, the report author, says she hopes the theft figures will convince Florida lawmakers to adopt a mandate for individual gun owners that already exists in 9 other states and the District of Columbia.
That is a piece of legislation that should be able to at least have a rational debate in the Florida legislature and would be something that would be a good step forward on this particular issue.
After all, Parsons says, combating gun theft should be less controversial than other gun control measures, like an assault weapons ban. But Patty Brigham, with the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence, says any gun control measure is an uphill battle in Florida. This year, Brigham says, lawmakers will continue pushing for open carry and campus carry. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Some school districts are chafing under a provision meant to adjust funding based on cost of living. Nick Evans reports they're applauding an effort to study the system, but for very different reasons.
Last month, two Republican Northeast Florida senators asked for a study of the District Cost Differential, or DCD. It's a cost of living adjustment embedded in the state's educational financing equation. Lawmakers actually approved the study, but it fell victim to Governor Rick Scott's veto. One of the senators asking to revive it now, rather than wait until next session, is St. Augustine Republican Travis Hudson.
What we've found out that it's doing, and we're hearing from most districts, is it's taking away, while it's great to give to some districts, it's taking away from others. So it's actually one of the only formulas where we take away from the FEFP for the district.
The state funding model, known as the Florida Education Finance Program, or FEFP, is a complex function, and the district cost differential is one of a couple of multipliers that go into determining a district's base funding. It's derived from the relative wages of a number of professions in each county. Put simply, if a district's DCD number is greater than 1, it receives extra money. If it's below 1, the district's funding contracts.
So you're seeing a lot of the what we're calling cash wealthy, bigger districts like Duval and Miami-Dade and some of the other ones, they're getting extra money, and some of what we'll call not cash wealthy, so the suburban areas around those, are losing money, actually coming out of their FEFP formula. So they're sending money to the state and they're not getting the dollar for dollar return.
So currently we send a dollar of our taxes to Tallahassee.
This is Melody Johnson. She chairs the Volusia County School Board.
And through this formula in Volusia County, we only get 96 cents back, which doesn't sound like a big deal until you add it up. We've lost $140 million since 2004, and we're losing $11 million alone this year.
Last year, she explains, a total of 55 counties had a DCD below 1. Again, that means 55 of Florida's 67 counties saw their district's base funding shrink. Johnson, like Hudson, says parents are commuting across county lines, and their wages are factoring into a different district's schools.
You cross the bridge, we call it, the bridge, and that goes into Seminole County. And as a result, if our parents drive over to Seminole County and work, their tax dollars stay in Seminole County for their schools.
Johnson is canvassing districts, urging them to pass resolutions calling on state lawmakers to revise the DCD so districts don't see their funding shrink. But what about those larger, so-called cash-wealthy districts, who see their funding totals rise thanks to the formula?
I am 100% in favor of a study on DCD. In fact, Miami-Dade proposed a DCD study that was passed by the legislature this year and then vetoed by the governor.
This is Ron Steiger, CFO for Miami-Dade Schools. He says the county's current DCD, which was the third highest in the state last year, simply isn't able to keep up with the cost of living in Miami-Dade.
The average rent in Miami-Dade for a one-bedroom apartment right now is over $1,500. The average rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Union County is probably less than $500.
Steiger points out a calculation change in 2003 reduced the amount of extra funding Miami-Dade receives. And, like Johnson, he has a running tally for how much it's cost his district. $1 billion. But when it comes to funding, Steiger believes a more fundamental fix might be needed. He points out for 2 years running, lawmakers have reduced millage rates for local school taxes to keep the dollar figure steady as property values rise. This is what's known as the required local effort. Meanwhile, Miami-Dade County is going to leave the millage rate steady.
And by keeping the millage rate flat, they're going to accrue hundreds of millions of dollars in extra revenue. If the legislature had taken that position with Miami-Dade County Public Schools, with districts all across the state, Just in this year alone, Miami-Dade County Public Schools would have received $106 million more.
Steiger suggests that additional county money will go to raises for people like firefighters and police, but not teachers. Eventually, much of the money will be pumped back into the local economy, pushing rents higher and raising the cost of living further. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, public health experts are changing their advice as concerns grow around the accuracy of one test for the Zika virus. The faulty test may be misleading pregnant mothers.
And then we scare women, and women will intervene in their pregnancies unnecessarily when they really haven't had an exposure during the pregnancy.
Congress joins the fight against websites that aid human traffickers, and the Florida delegation is standing at the forefront.
The only question that we have is not relative to censoring it, it's not relative to shutting down the internet, it's relative to can we build the tools that are better than their tools to fight what's happening.
The North Florida battle over a proposed deep well to hold contaminated landfill runoff continues and escalates.
That injection zone would have to contain an aquifer with water that is not fit for human consumption.
And even in schools without strict dress codes, the gap between what boys and girls are allowed to wear stirs controversy among grown-ups and anger among students.
One day she just got off the bus and the teacher that Sunday I was talking about was like, honey, I think you need to go change, like go call your parents.
Florida has confirmed its first sexually transmitted case of the Zika virus of this year. That comes as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are changing their recommendations for testing pregnant women for the disease. Kate Payne reports the new guidance means more patients may go without screening.
Being pregnant is never easy, but the Zika virus can make the experience even more stressful, challenging, and confusing. It's not always clear what pregnant women should do.
I have a daughter that's pregnant right now with twins. She's very, of course, like most anybody pregnant, wants to have a healthy child.
That's Florida Governor Rick Scott talking with local officials and public health experts in Doral earlier this summer.
And so she constantly asks me about how we're doing at the state level with regard to Zika. I remind her that you have to do personally. You don't have any standing water around your house, your business. Know to use bug repellent, use protective clothing.
Now some of the guidance for pregnant women is changing again. The CDC is discouraging the use of the antibody test when screening for the Zika virus.
We are emphasizing the use of this nucleic acid test for pregnant women.
That's the CDC's Zika Response Incident Manager, Henry Walk. According to the agency, all pregnant women should talk to their doctors about Zika. But the organization now says those with symptoms living in places with ongoing exposure, like Puerto Rico, should definitely get tested. Those in areas with outbreaks but no symptoms should consider testing. Women who travel to a place with local transmission and don't develop symptoms don't have to get tested. But Walk says there is room for flexibility.
If the provider and the patient, the pregnant woman, feels that they've had significant exposure or other reasons, certainly that testing could be performed. But both the provider and the patient need to understand the limitations of the testing in that context.
He says the reason the CDC is discouraging the use of the antibody test is because public health experts are increasingly worried about its accuracy.
And so our concern is that in this very low incident setting, or a setting where the cases are very low, that a number of the tests that we're conducting, especially on asymptomatic pregnant women, actually might be false positives, not true positives. And so
the problem is evidence of Zika exposure stays in the body longer than experts thought. The antibody or IgM test can't reliably tell the difference between an inactive virus and an active one.
And so therefore, it makes it more difficult to differentiate, for example, in a territory like Puerto Rico, if a woman who's positive now actually was exposed last season. And so we can't tell if a woman is recently infected or actually potentially immune.
Those false positives can unintentionally put pregnant women in a really difficult situation.
And then we scare women, and women will intervene in their pregnancies unnecessarily when they really haven't had an exposure during the pregnancy.
Karen Harris chairs the Florida chapter of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The constantly evolving guidance can be hard to track. And Walk acknowledges the possibility that patients who really should get tested may not. But he says that chance is vanishingly small compared to the number of false positives.
When the majority of the tests that we're using to interpret or provide some guidance to pregnant women are actually false, we felt that it's important really to update our guidance.
The CDC is encouraging patients and their physicians to work together to decide any possible screenings and treatments. And Harris wants her colleagues to stay up to date with the newest information.
Make sure your physician follows the latest CDC guidelines. What I'm telling you today could change next week.
Walk says the changes will likely shift more responsibility onto pediatricians. They'll be the ones keeping tabs on babies who may develop symptoms of undiagnosed Zika exposure. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Both of Florida's U.S. Senators, Republican Marco Rubio and Democrat Bill Nelson, have joined 18 of their congressional colleagues on a truly bipartisan mission. They filed legislation cracking down on websites which knowingly facilitate online sex trafficking. As Sasha Cordner reports, they're targeting one website in particular.
Backpage.com is a website that allows for classified advertising like job postings or apartments for sale. But it was earlier this year when the site got on the radar of U.S. senators like Florida Republican Marco Rubio for a different reason.
Local organization is filing a federal lawsuit against Backpage.com, and it found that in my hometown in Miami-Dade, over half the adult victims in human trafficking cases and 40% of minor victims were being advertised on Backpage.com.
According to an investigative report released by U.S. senators this year, Backpage is a leading online marketplace for commercial sex, and it's involved in 73% of all child trafficking reports to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The report also states Backpage is knowingly editing its, quote, adult ads, coaching its users to post, quote, clean ads for illegal transactions, and deleting incriminating language that company filters miss.
Some are now asserting, and I agree, that this is nothing more than a publicity stunt. In the end, didn't they just change the name of the same activity?
Backpage, they shut down one section of their site and another section pops up. These things become incumbent upon us having a malleable tool that can effectively work in all markets.
That's actor Ashton Kutcher, who's also the co-founder of an anti-human trafficking group called Thorn, Digital Defenders of Children. Thorn stands for Tech Innovation to Fight Child Sexual Exploitation. As part of his group's work, they've spoken to several online platforms about looking into these issues. Kutcher says while some are willing to distance themselves, other sites like Backpage appear more resistant about taking down the sex ads.
I talked to the founder and the CEO of Backpage 5 years ago and said, we're watching, we know what's happening. I know you know what's happening. You can either join us in the fight against it or you're going to become the tool for it, and they really sort of didn't want to hear about it.
And Human Rights First President and CEO Alyssa Massimino says she believes Backpage needs to be held accountable for what it's doing. She says there's evidence that they've doctored up to 80% of their ads to conceal illegal transactions.
It appears that they are intentionally altering ads to make underage people look like they are consenting adults, and that is despicable and wrong, and they should be held accountable for that.
Kutcher and Massimino spoke during a Senate hearing months ago about human trafficking, which included talk of legislation. Now, Rubio, Florida's Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, and 18 others have filed the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. The goal is to update the Communications Decency Act to clarify that websites that knowingly facilitate sex trafficking can be held liable and the victim can seek justice against them. It also eliminates federal liability protections for such websites and allows state law enforcement groups to investigate such claims. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Local government in Jackson County, Florida, is still battling a proposal from the waste management company to build a new injection well in the area. Morgan Danford brings us the latest on how the public opposition to the well is growing as the county awaits a decision from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection on whether the project can proceed.
Local officials have recruited allies in other counties, organizations, and recently the office of Florida Senator Bill Nelson.
So I've gotten into this issue to try to help you by bringing some attention to it from the standpoint of me trying to get the federal government through the EPA interested. EPA definitely does have a stake when it comes to the quality of drinking water. And therefore, that is the hook that I'm using to go.
Nelson recently met with Jackson County commissioners and city managers to get a better grasp on the problem. Part of the issue is whether the well is needed. Waste Management says its plants in Sneeds and Mariana are operating at full capacity and that it needs the new well as another place to put leachate. But Sneeds City Manager Connie Butts told Senator Nelson that neither plants are running at full capacity. She says both are more than able to accept more garbage and leachate.
But I'm also wondering where all the leachate is coming from. In 2013, March 2013, I signed a contract with them to take up to 2 loads a day because what they told me then was their tank was full. And if they could get me to take 2 loads a day, that would empty their tank. It would keep them caught up. Then all of a sudden, I find out they're sending how many loads to you on a regular basis? And now all of a sudden they have way too much leachate that they can't keep up with. Where is all the extra leachate? Are they hauling this in?
But says the counties don't produce enough garbage for the tanks to be full. The proposed permit would only allow Waste Management to drill an exploratory well. That well is meant to determine if the geology is appropriate and give the data to the state DEP. Waste Management's Dolehite says the company has no intention to drill in a place that would potentially harm an aquifer. In fact, he says they're looking for an aquifer that is not drinkable or treatable.
That injection zone would have to contain an aquifer with water that is not fit for human consumption.
DEP spokeswoman Deanne Miller says the agency is still reviewing the application and is continuing to communicate with stakeholders to answer questions and provide information. She says the approval process is, quote, rigorous and that the company must meet environmental and human health requirements under state and federal regulations. The company would also have to apply for another permit for each phase of construction on the well. Still, it's of little comfort to Jackson County. Administrator Ernie Padgett says he, the commissioners, residents, and allies are all preparing to do anything they can to keep the well out of the county.
What I've been telling Waste Management people is what I'd recommend they do is voluntarily back off of this request and do what they can to make a run at the scientific data and things that they think will say, all right, this is the best alternative to dispose of this leachate. So I'm hoping that personally that will happen.
And residents like Johnny Roberts will be there fighting until the issue comes to a compromise.
I'm going to fight it as long as I can stand.
Mariana City Commissioners adopted a resolution against the well, and Nelson has written a letter to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency in support of the county's stance. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Morgan Danford.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, for many young girls, it's hard navigating middle and high school. There's the cafeteria politics to cope with, coupled with changing relationships among friends and family. It's also a time for body changes. And as Lynn Hatter reports, one group of young women says with all they have going on, the last thing they want to deal with is a dress code.
It starts with an observation.
I'm Lakshmina Ryan, and sometimes I feel like it's kind of unfair, particularly to us girls. Like, the boys don't get much flack about their clothes and what they're wearing all the time. Like, they could wear shorts to school and they wouldn't care, but if girls wear shorts to school, and it's mostly about how these clothes are made, because if girl shorts were made like boy shorts, then we wouldn't have a problem.
And then there's this response from middle schooler Dana Smith.
I like to express who I am and how I feel. I have a right to do that as a U.S. citizen, and it is unfair for the schools to make us try to be all the same when we're really not at all.
Lakshmi and Dana recently came to the WFSU studios as part of the annual SciGirls Summer Camp. But the issue weighing heaviest on their minds is the dress code, specifically the way schools enforce it. The struggle is real. leggings or jeggings, shorts or skirts, width of straps, length of shirt. And the older a girl gets, the more complicated these rules become. Yet boys are not held to the same standards.
I mean, boys, they don't really have a set dress code. And there's some boys who come to our school wearing these, like,
super short shorts.
They wore boxers.
Yes.
Like, okay. They came to our school wearing boxers.
Their boxers are not even, and they're these tiny, tiny shorts. And we're just like, well, they're wearing, like,
they were
nothing.
Super short.
Like,
chubbies.
Yeah, chubbies. Like, it's like,
that's a thing.
That's what they're called. And they're, like, up to, like.
Oh, they wore muscle tanks.
These are high schoolers Isabella Augustine, Aaliyah Davis, Caitlin Nguyen, Sandhya Kumar, and Emma Bryson. In a recent blog post, the American Civil Liberties Union noted the dress code gender bias against girls. And Emma says her school has even gone so far as to separate the boys and girls specifically to lecture them on what not to wear.
We were talked to about in one of our classes, like the boys had to be pushed out. And we were talked to about how the girls had to start wearing longer skirts.
Yeah.
Because because the boys couldn't control themselves if our skirts were too short.
But boys wear some short shorts at our school.
That's Aaliyah Davis. At issue for these young women is the way the schools enforce the dress code policies. All the girls who spoke agree on the need for rules, but Caitlin Nguyen says the way the policies are applied is often subjective and outright discriminatory. She says when a girl gets called out, it can be a hurtful and humiliating experience, one she's witnessed firsthand.
There are some skinny girls that they don't pay attention to, but there's like this bigger girl, and one day she just got off the bus, and the teacher that Sandhya was talking about was like, honey, I think you need to go change, like go call your parents.
When it comes to dress codes, Emma Mikado, a Leon High School sophomore, says she sees stereotypes at play.
I think it's because of just gender stereotypes and body stereotypes. Like if you have a certain build, you have to do a certain thing, or if you don't have that build, you can't do that. So if you're wearing certain clothes, but you don't look the same way someone else would wearing those same clothes, like you said, you would be punished differently or not be punished.
What I was listening to as a mom, because I've got three girls at home, and dress code, it is hard to find shorts that are long enough and straps that are wide enough.
Susan Garaki is a teacher who's now working as a guidance counselor. She admits what's considered fashionable often conflicts with school dress codes. Some policies ban logos on clothing, and there's one on nearly every stitch of it on the market. Even socks are subjected to the rules. But Garaki says despite the headaches and the complaints, those rules are in place for a reason.
As a teacher, I definitely want them. My motto is modest is hottest. I always teach that to my students, to my girls at home. Like, nobody wants to see everything.
The girls say they're not pushing to abolish the dress code, and they're certainly not out to show everything. But they want to be comfortable, and they'd like to see the rules enforced more fairly between girls and boys. After all, they say they really hate those chubby shorts boys wear, which Aaliyah Davis notes are way more than 3 inches above the knee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Morgan Danford and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.